I'm Mehran Mehrigani. I've been in the department since 1990. I joined the department right out of graduate school, and the 15 years have gone by pretty quickly. The last 3 years I've been chairing the department, which in itself has been a learning experience, and I'll be going back to just doing research and teaching at the end of this year, or as of January 1, when our new department chair will assume responsibility. One of the things that I'd like to do always with my research is try to see if there is value in it in the marketplace. And from my point of view, and this is a personal point of view, it's more of a test as to the things that we do in research, which are really intended for graduate education. Are we putting those resources to work additionally to the benefit of society, and therefore getting the personal fulfillment that someone would be willing to pay out of their own pocket to buy something that our research created? And of course, to do that, you have to take the research out of the university into the marketplace, and you usually do that through a company, either licensing it out to a company that commercializes it, or you start a company that takes the technology and commercializes the technology. Now, I teach in the TIME program, and in fact, I teach a course called Engineering Entrepreneurship. And this year, I co-teach it with Nick Forlini, so he will be here on Wednesday. He will cover the topic of IP. And today, I will try to give you a feel for entrepreneurship. How many of you went to the Dean Kamen lecture last week? Good. What did you think? Good? What caught your attention? What was the surprise? No surprises?
Oh, come on. At least the Dean shirts.
Hey, what did you think? Well, we have a lot of shy people in this class.
Isn't he a college dropout?
Is he a college dropout? I don't know.
I believe
he is a college dropout. I don't know. What did you think of this discussion of innovation? Not very structured, right? And one of the things I'll do today is show you how companies now starting to view innovation as a very structured type of approach. But this neat stuff that he is doing, no? And the neat stuff is taking technology that's already available, putting it together in the form of products. At the university, we usually also create the technology, and then the challenge is to take it out in the form of products. So, in order to take products to the marketplace, be it through an existing company or a startup, which is more the focus of my talk today and sort of the focus of our discussion here, because the assumption is that you may at this time with your senior projects or at a later time in your career want to take what you've done and create your own company and commercialize it. Core in that process is this topic of innovation. So from Dean's lecture, what did you figure innovation means? He did have a very quick definition, which is the accepted definition nowadays, early on in his lecture. Anyone remembers that?
What? Remember, he defined invention. Right? He said, innovation is the process of taking inventions to the marketplace, or invention plus exploitation. This would be the economic, of course, exploitation. And that's the definition that more or less people use now. So it's easy to invent, actually relatively easy, particularly in a university environment or research environment. It's not that difficult to invent. But it's much harder to innovate, meaning putting that invention to work and taking it to the marketplace. And actually, to do that, you have to have a business model around it, right? And the business model means simply figuring out how to make money.
That should at least get your interest.
Yes? Making money is important. So technological innovation is a multi-stage process. And companies are increasingly trying to capture and define that multi-stage process. They like to define it as a process. Why do you think companies like to define the process of innovation as innovation as a process? What makes cooking easy? Recipe, right? What's a recipe? A process. If you have a process for innovation, what does that mean? You can innovate easily. At least you can lubricate the process of innovation in the company. You can turn the handle for process and get more innovation. Yes.
It also means that you can sell that process to somebody else. Like if your company has this process embedded in it, that gives your company a value.
Exactly. So in a way, that's a good point. In a way, again, comes back to generating value through creativity, but creativity that has a business model added to it to do that economic exploitation. So this is actually becoming a hot topic. If you read over the last year or two, increasingly Fortune 50 companies like GE, Procter & Gamble, 3M, they're all talking about the innovation. And the reason for that is with the stock market bust, essentially, they spent about 3 years cost-cutting. And they cut a lot of the fat out of the business. At some point, you can't cut any more costs. You've cut all the costs you can. So what do you have to do? Start increasing the top line, the revenue line. You can only increase through innovation, offering more products and services in the marketplace. So for that reason, over the last couple of years, there's a lot of emphasis on innovation, in particular from Fortune 50 companies. The other is global competition. The internet has gone a long way to make knowledge available everywhere at any time, essentially, and communication available. With those two, the world has become even a more competitive place, and to survive in a competitive environment, you have to be innovative. You've got to constantly field new products and services to stay ahead of competition. So if you read what these CEOs are saying in the Fortune 50 companies, innovation is a hot topic. Okay? All talk about innovation. So when you go on job interviews, make sure you have the jargon. And one of those is innovation and innovation management. Okay? So if they can capture a process, they can actually manage it. Now, one of the things that's changed about the understanding of the corporate world or the change of culture of the corporate world that's helpful to startups is the following. In the old days, companies sort of had their R&D, and that R&D grew to be a central R&D laboratory within companies. Okay? So large companies had a central R&D. The idea was you throw money at this central R&D, the researchers will innovate. You take their innovation through the manufacturing and engineering and make products. That model sort of went on till probably sometime in the late 60s, early 70s. Okay? And then the companies thought that, well, these researchers are a bunch of freeloaders. You know, they throw all this money into the R&D centers, and very little comes up from the other end. Most of the time, it's our engineering that produces the products and services. The researchers come in around 10 o'clock, get their coffee, walking around, socializing, you know. So they don't like that. So they said, well, let's go to a new model. Let's start shifting from the central R&D, which is this sort of researchers in their Ivy towers having a good time. And there's not a lot of accountability on them. And you saw some of those central R&D facilities, laboratories, including the latest Bell Labs, got essentially dissolved. And so they went to a model of incorporating R&D in the business units. Okay? So what happened is they broke down that central R&D and aligned the R&D to the business units. Each business unit in a company is a soft company, think of it, that's trying to commercialize in one set of products and services that they have expertise so they can focus. So they broke the R&D down, put it in the business units, and said, this way the business manager says, hey, if you want to get paid to the R&D folks, you better be doing what I need. So the business units would largely orient the R&D. And then the CTO in the company became more and more sort of a coordinator. So you have a CTO office, the chief technology officer. They largely do coordination of research and research strategy across the company. The business units do their own R&D. And that's sort of the view of process occurs primarily within the organization. Now, what's happened in the last few years, increasingly the company is realizing that, well, you know, with the internet availability or availability of knowledge and communication, I know that not all the smart people work for me. In fact, I probably didn't get a lot of them. Okay? I was out there hiring, and not all the smart people work for me. Even if they do, I probably have 1% of the workforce for a Fortune 50 company. Maybe has the 1% of the workforce in engineering in that given area. What about the other 99%? Well, I can't really start relying entirely on my own organization. Then the other issue is that cost of R&D is becoming more and more because just the nature of technology and increasingly going to more and more system development, the cost of R&D is increasing in some claim faster than the revenue can increase at the company. So it's not cost effective to do everything internally, which is really good news for you if you're going to start a company, because companies have started looking outside, okay? This concept of open innovation. I've got a need. Why look inside first to see if I can develop it? I will look outside, see if someone else has developed it. I can just buy it from them, or can I pay someone else with better expertise who can do it cheaper, faster, and better to do it for me? So this concept of going external is getting a lot of attention these days. So market pull more frequently leads to successful innovation that does technology push. What does market pull mean, you think?
Wow, you seem like a living dead. Come on. Right?
Oh, they were up all night working on their intro.
Oh, really?
Rather than trying to develop a new technology, look for something that the market actually is demanding.
Exactly. Look in the marketplace, see what the market needs, and then do your innovation to solve the market need. That's a lot more effective because if you innovate, you know that the market is available for it. Did you bring lunch for me too? Technology push is when you advance the technology looking for then an application in the marketplace. And it's not always obvious, you know. Usually there are a lot of, whoa, Frank, this is dying.
Uh-oh.
It's so high intensity, quickly drains the battery.
Oh, it also...
No, okay.
I was going to say, the batteries have been there for a year.
And so anyway,
there's a market opportunity for their batteries.
So it's not always clear that you develop a technology. Here they call it a solution looking for a problem. Okay, you develop a solution, you're out there looking for a problem to solve. It's not always that effective. So essentially, recap, innovation is invention plus some business model to economically exploit it. Companies are trying to, innovation is a real hot topic and innovation management for companies. Another hot topic is how to get what I need from outside rather than internally. In effect, they're augmenting. It's important what you know, and it's important who you know. In the old days, it was largely it's important what you know. Now the other piece is being added. It's important who you know
to get what you need from it, from that party. So there are some basic terminologies you should know in the context of technological innovation. Basic research is the concept of no specific application in mind. That's what a lot of us professors do at the university. It's nice because there's not a lot of pressure. You know, they just sort of work on problems we like to work on. Applied research is where you have a specific application in mind, but there's no product in mind, okay? For example, in my own work, basic research may be developing silicon carbide material deposition capability. Okay. Applied research may be developing a silicon carbide pressure sensor or the fabrication processes and material properties to create a pressure sensor. Product development is, or pressure sensing actually, specific application. In a, let's say, high temperature environment, product development would be specific application and specific products. So this would be pressure sensor, maybe for in-cylinder pressure monitoring in an internal combustion engine. Okay, and that product development is then cycles of development prototyping, engineering prototyping, and eventually manufacturing prototyping. Okay. And you can innovate in any of these. And you can take technologies at any of these stages to the market through your startup activities or through an existing organization. Of course, the further down you are, the closer you are to sort of getting to the economic payoff, but also likely competition is more and the payoff is not as large because the risk is less. Now, here I have definition of innovation for Goodrich Corporation, okay? So they are trying to define for their company innovation so that they can innovate more. And they define innovation as a process of adding business value, because if it doesn't add business value, meaning that at the end of the day, add to their shares to provide shareholders their value, there's just, you know, why waste their time. Through demonstrated creativity in products, processes, procedures, and programs. Notice that in everything, essentially, they say apply creativity in everything to add business value in a process that they want to can. So again, you see the notion of process and how companies are trying to capture a definition of innovation, because that's what leads to differentiators and to competitive advantage. What do you think of this versus what Dean Kamen said?
Followed this?
The question is, I mean, it's like, you know, the large companies say this, but at the same time, there is Dean Kamen as a counterexample. So, making innovation a process works within a certain context to a certain extent, but then, you know, there's other ways to do it too.
Don't the large companies come and hire him?
But actually, if you really break through his presentation, he has a process that he innovates by. That's why he could come up with the rules and stuff. But as an inventor, remember, you know, Dean Kamen is a very good businessman. A very good businessman needs an image. Okay, he's got a special image he's had for himself. So the image is the out-of-the-box innovator. Comes with the jeans, you know, the denim stuff. And it says that, well, innovation isn't really a process, but really, if you break down, otherwise, it couldn't give me the suggestions. And what was it, the other thing, the stuff he was giving? The lessons learned or stuff like that. If you didn't really have a process generally, it's not like he gets up in the morning all of a sudden and says, I'm going to work on this or I'm going to go about this in such and such way. It just comes to it. There's a process they follow. There's another company here locally on the hill called Nottingham Spur.
they are also one of these invention think tanks or houses, design houses. They all of these have processes. It only sort of what they give you externally is how they want to position themselves from a marketing and image point of view. If they, for example, in the case of Dean, if he came and really was in a suit and tie and presented a very structured process, well, Procter & Gamble may say, well, we've got equivalent of that in-house. You know, we've got a lot of people with a lot of management and innovation experience. We've got processes. In fact, for example, in the case of Goodrich, they have Harvard Business School faculty that come in and do all of the stuff under this process. There are a whole bunch of exercises that they put the company and the employees through, which, you know, they're interesting, and they actually help you innovate better. They don't make you better innovators, but they help you innovate better, because there's a cultural aspect to this as well. So let me now, so tied to innovation, there are a few other terms: incremental, distinctive, and breakthrough. Incremental is small improvements over present practice and state of the art. Distinctive is significant advances or improvements, but based largely on the same technology. Breakthrough is new solutions based on fundamentally different technologies and approaches. Who can give an example of incremental innovation from your everyday life? What's an incremental innovation nowadays? Computers nowadays, for the most part, are incremental from one model to the next. How about distinctive? Significant advances or improvements, but fundamentally based on same technology.
What about iPod?
iPod is largely distinctive because everything in it is based on current technology.
You're right.
How about breakthrough?
Self-technology
is breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. The transistor.
The transistor at the time was breakthrough, exactly. So you can see how types of innovation fall out. And sort of the technology management process, you go from a vision to sort of project or ideas to project selection to building products, and then seeing what the customer sort of needs and says, and bringing that back and just iterating to improve this over and over again. So what's good about a process facilitates more innovation. You can apply it at all levels and all steps of an organization, has best practices for each stage to ensure effectiveness and efficiency, has suggested metrics at each stage. Now, if you're a startup company and initially you have the entrepreneur and then you're adding people, I mean, you don't go through this process formally. If you're a Fortune 50 company, there's no way not to go through the process formally. That's essentially the difference. And I'm going to skip this and then go to the actual lecture on entrepreneurship. All right. So entrepreneurship 101. Entrepreneurs provide the creative force capitalism needs to work. Is that true? Some of you are laughing. It's largely true, right? It's hard for capitalism to work if there weren't entrepreneurs. Because entrepreneurs, the free market makes capitalism work. Definition, you know, who's an entrepreneur? Person who undertakes the creation of an enterprise that has a chance of success. Bold, imaginative, deviator from established business methods and practices. Or it may be based on business methods and practices that are established. I mean, so you've got the spectrum of people who you define as entrepreneurs. Do you know any entrepreneurs in your family?
Yes.
Yes? No? Yeah, usually, you know, there are a lot of entrepreneurs around us. Do you know what the living dead means? I'll give you a hint. It's the term used by venture capitalists. No? No guesses? I think it's because this room has no windows. The venture capitalists, you know, there are companies that don't go out of business, they stay in business and they go on, but they never have a chance of a reasonable upside that can lead to value generation from a venture capitalist point of view. They call them the living dead. If the companies essentially are living, they go on, but from a venture capitalist point of view, they're dead because they won't ever lead to a big liquidity event. So, not all about wealth creation. Focus is often on serving society and making a positive change. In fact, if you talk to entrepreneurs, it's rare that making money is their first reason to do entrepreneurial activity. In fact, the sort of model I described to you relies on making meaning. Now, that doesn't mean that generating wealth and getting rich is not one of the things that they like to do in the process, but usually it's not the only motive or the top motive that they get into creating a business or a startup. Does that make sense to you? Usually entrepreneurs are in fact passionate about what they're trying to do, sometimes to their own detriment. And they're so passionate about it that they don't take business metrics into account. So, they're usually people who create businesses, maybe totally based on new ideas or radical ideas. Usually there is a personal sort of emotional connection to what they're trying to do. This in particular is true about academics. And academics who start businesses and then get venture capitalists involved are often disenchanted because they are very emotionally attached to what they're taking to the marketplace, while the venture folks are entirely economically driven. And so that creates a little bit of a bad experience until they get seasoned for, you know. So, entrepreneurs have been around for a long time, especially in this country and in Europe, sort of in the West, as well as in Asia, countries like Japan. They've been the fabric of our society for generations. Here are some examples. Value-creating, world-changing businesses. What did Rockefeller start? World-changing business? Standard Oil of Ohio? How about Andrew Carnegie? Steel Baron? Right? Thomas Edison? He had a number of things.
Yeah.
Right?
How many patents did he have?
And Henry Ford? GM, right?
Yeah. Thanks for trying.
I was just testing.
Might get the dead a little bit.
That's it. Cardiac shock. So new enterprises, explosive growth in new venture creation over the past 30 years. Why do you think that is? Okay, I won't go on until you answer. We can just stand here staring.
It's not on your exams.
I mean, the internet boom bust is a good example of this, but this trend has been ongoing, or the expansion of it has been ongoing the last 30 years.
American culture, the American way.
So in some ways, it's role modeling and cultural changes, right? You see more and more entrepreneurs succeeding. That means, hey, if so-and-so is doing it, why can I? In fact, if you live in the Silicon Valley area or Southern California area, where there are a lot of successful entrepreneurs, which in fact you run into them and socialize with them, you know, the guy may be worth $500 million, but you run into them in the grocery store, you may socialize with them because 5 years earlier, they were an engineer like you. So people say, hey, if so-and-so can do it, I can do it too. If Henry Samueli can do it, you know, I can do it too. I was Henry's student, or I was Henry's colleague. Who knows what Henry Samueli founded? His UCLA professor, Broadcom, don't worry about it. So one is role modeling as well as cultural shifts. Yeah.
Technology tends to build on itself. So we've got a lot more accumulated technological capability.
So the pace of enabling technology and how it's built on itself would be another one.
We also have a lot more education, a lot more widespread, which led to a lot more people seeing vendors and opportunities in the market.
So the know-how of how to start companies has increased as well. You know, there are increasingly more books. You can go to the library, get read, take advantage of other people's experience in a documented, educated way. Now the business schools feed into that. Another one is the risk investment. Venture capitalists have grown substantially, so risk investment has become more and more widely available. So you have a good idea, you can get the money. In the old days, you had to go to a bank, have some sort of a collateral, or somehow show them how good looking you are, and so they give you the money. But now, you know, risk capital is more widely available, and it's really grown exponentially in the last 30 years, in fact, in the last 10 years. So that's been helpful. Dozens of new companies have emerged that have changed our way of life over the past 30 years. Give me some examples before I show you the next view graph. Just shout them out.
Apple, Microsoft.
What happened?
IBM.
Uh-oh. This didn't come up.
Oh, I noticed that's all an Apple product.
I know. Because Nick put these view graphs together. He uses an Apple. But it's like Google, FedEx, Starbucks, Yahoo, eBay,
Kinos.
All these are companies that have changed the way we live. So the challenge, driving factor for most entrepreneurs, not money, a call to respond to a difficult task. In particular, the technological types that sort of they're intellectually driven. They want to show how smart they are, come up with something others couldn't come up with. The commitment to undertake the required enterprise. And this is not for everyone because there's substantial risk associated with starting a company and trying to make a business. You, more often than not, you fail. So you have to sort of be used to failing in order to succeed. And again, not for everyone. You guys know him? Guys or girls? Yeah. Pretty flamboyant guy. Ever since I was a teenager, if something was a challenge, I did it and learned it. That's what interests me about life, setting myself tests and trying to prove that I can do it. See what a big ego Donald Trump has? So a lot of these personality factors have to play in for entrepreneurs to be entrepreneurs and succeed. Okay, now to overcome challenges, deal with a series of tough issues along the way. Every part of your business that you're starting and moving forward with, there are a lot of tough issues. One of the toughest issues most people don't think about is layoff. If you're an entrepreneur, you start your business, you hire people. Inevitably, you have to fire them, right? Either your business turns down, so you have to reduce your workforce, or you decided you hired the wrong person. Firing a person is harder for the person firing often than the person being fired. Okay? Because you have to sit across the table from them. They probably have a family, and you lay them off. It's a tough thing to do. That's just one example. A shareholder letter is another one. When things aren't going well, you have to sort of write to the shareholders and say things aren't going well. No one likes to lose money, so they'll call and really abuse you. Create solutions and work to perfect them. Essentially, you know, you have to come up with solutions to the tough problems you face, and then have to improve them. One of the things that is really helpful is not explicitly put out here. An entrepreneur has to be very fluid. If you have a very rigid personality, you probably won't make a good entrepreneur because there are so many unanticipated things. The business plan that you write will get revised along the way so many times. But unless you're fluid and can adapt and sort of be comfortable with changing some of the assumptions and decisions you make, it'll be very tough on you. You've got to juggle many things at the same time, have to manage your company while you're also doing technical innovation, while you may be in the lab actually soldering the resistors. You've got to figure out what furniture you buy for various offices. Just a ton of stuff. Accounting, taxes, all that. Be resilient in the face of setbacks. Most time things don't work. Once in a while they do, it feels great. But for those feel great moments, there are a lot of good moments that don't feel that great. Not expect easy solutions. If it was easy, everyone would do it. Acquire problem-solving skills. This is really important. How to do critical thinking and out-of-box thinking to solve problems. Learn and acquire new skills. One of the things you have to do on the job is learn. I remember when I had my first company, I bought a big piece of equipment and assuming that I learned some accounting along the way as I've gone. I figured I'd buy this piece of equipment and just write it off and go. At the end of the year, the accountant comes to me and says, this is sort of, these are the financials. And I look at that and you're about $250,000 off from what I thought the financials should be. So I'm like, what's going on? So you look at that, and all of a sudden I discover, oh, this big piece of equipment has to be depreciated. He says, I'm like, what is depreciation? He says, well, the tax code doesn't let you write off this whole thing. You have to write it off slowly, slowly. So then I had to scramble and figure out where to find money and all that stuff. So you've got to learn the skills along the way, but also not be afraid to tackle the problems that come along the way. So then I learned depreciation. Learned a lot of legal stuff. Learned how to do due diligence, all of these. So you've got to be able to learn these new skills as you go along, but it's not a big deal. Hey, if he can survive Professor Merritt, all the rest of this stuff is easy.
Or Professor Sears.
So, idea versus opportunity. So, let's go to the next thing. You're sitting there, you have an idea. I have a great business idea. It's probably one of the ones I'm going to do later when I really have time. I think there should be a business to human taxidermy. We put over the fireplace, and then put on the mantle the pictures of our grandfathers and ancestors. Wouldn't it be much nicer to have your grandfather's head right over there? Very wide, looking at it. Rather than burying the poor old man, he's had the pictures around the videos, he's taxidermy. You can do the full figure, you can do the head. And whatever makes you feel good. I think there's a real business in that. It's socially not acceptable yet, but they the world becomes more absurd. You could sell it to some of the rock bands, I think. So that's an idea. It's a concept for a new venture. Okay? I don't know if it's an opportunity. Do you think it's an opportunity?
Well, it's a small select group of people.
So, you know, opportunity is a concept for a new venture with a greater than average chance of success. I think the human taxidermy would have a greater than average chance of success. That'd be shocking. Just think about that. So opportunities are timely, solvable, important, profitable, in context. Right? Current need, pain, or problem. The opportunity has to exist now. You can't address yesterday's opportunity. Today, tomorrow's opportunity is outstanding to address if you can figure it out. And there are techniques here. You can watch trends and try to extrapolate where these trends will take you and try to guess at tomorrow's opportunity. But they have to be timely, solvable. Otherwise, if you can't solve it, well, it's hard to offer a product or service, right? There was a nice Gilbert cartoon this weekend where Gilbert went to buy a chair, and the lady was saying that, well, did you see it? A lady was saying that, I can sell you the idea of buying a chair, and then we can pretend the delivery date is a month from now, but every 3 months you call me and I'll tell you, you know, when the next delivery date is. So he comes home, and Dogbert asks him, do you buy a chair? And he says, it's hard to know. That's the concept of solvable. Yeah, is it solvable? Are you going to have a chair? Important, wanted by customers. If it's not important, well, it's not an opportunity. Profitable, this is one of the most important. Many times things are timely, they're solvable, they're important, they're in context, but there's no way to find a business model to make them profitable. Okay. In my own field, which is sensors and MEMS, everyone knows a 3-axis accelerometer would be timely, it's solvable, it's important, it's in context, but most of the big killer applications that need it, you can't make them profitable yet.
Any comments on these? Any one of you who wants to start the human taxidermy business?
Don't forget the last point.
Not all ideas are opportunities. Okay? Actually, can you give me an example of a business that was a good idea but wasn't an opportunity?
There were a lot of .com ones. It seemed like a good idea at the time. What?
Blues.
Which one is that?
It was internet money.
Okay.
Where you pay them money and then you can use their money at certain merchants that like will be Goldberg. This doesn't show.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of these. So this concept of sweet spot is important. In order to have a chance at success, there has to be an attractive opportunity. There has to be interest and passion on the part of the person who wants to go after this opportunity. And that person has to have capabilities and skills to do it. There's a famous venture capitalist in town. His name is David Morgenthaler, Morgenthaler Ventures. It's a pretty big venture firm that has operations in Cleveland, mostly mergers and acquisitions types of M&A, but their real VC activities are in Silicon Valley. And he's got a good analogy. He says to have a good startup, for him to fund a startup is you need a good race,
with a good horse and a good jockey. Okay? What do you think the race, what is the analogy, or the, what is the race being an analogy to? You have to have a good race. Market size, exactly. There's got to be a good market size. If you're only going to sell 10 of them, you know, versus 10 million or 10 billion, how about the horse? The idea, okay? And the jockey, the management. So, good management, good idea, and a big market. So that makes it simple for himself.
There is an upsurge. We already talked about this, but U.S. by far is one of the leading entrepreneurial company. You may be surprised to see Finland in there. You know, the U.K., maybe Ireland. So, sort of gives you a list.
I'm surprised China's not in that list.
China is still
their economic model,
but it's only developing recently. Well, much of that was government-based. What is the date on this?
2002.
Yeah, 2002. So a lot of that will be forthcoming. Now, there's another thing called entrepreneurship. That's when you're an entrepreneur inside your large organization company. So you go get a job with GE, and you act like an entrepreneur inside GE, for example. Keep to driving new product lines and valuable innovations. So often, within the large companies, there are these individuals who are much more entrepreneurial, and they push the cost. The entrepreneur assumes many of the risks and takes many of the challenges as a traditional entrepreneur. And sort of the risk there is that if you fail, most of the time, it's unlikely that you're going to be promoted up the chain. I mean, you really... There's a lot of risk to be an entrepreneur within a large company. For example, think of Procter & Gamble. Fortune 50 company, extremely competitive. They hire the best people. In fact, their management rejects are running GE, eBay, Intuit. These are the people who didn't make it inside Procter, okay? Running the, some of the biggest companies in the world. Gives you a feel for how competitive it is within Procter to get promoted to the top and how good you have to be and the level of effort you have to put in. So you've got to really be careful to take risks, but on the other hand, if you don't take risks, you probably aren't going to go up to the top. So it makes it challenging. Some of the companies, you know, 3M is known as the innovation company, but probably Procter & Gamble is one of the best examples of innovation companies. So I want to capture in the remaining time for you this sort of theory of starting a company. And I did it from the textbook. We use this in our engineering entrepreneurship course. There's a textbook that I have high regard for, and Nick Berlini does too, called The Art of the Start. It's written by Guy G.U.Y. Kawasaki, just like the Kawasaki motorcycle. And I highly recommend you buy it and read it. It doesn't matter if you want to start a company or not. Many of the things that he describes are good for starting any initiative and sort of organizing your thoughts and steps and processes for starting something and thinking about it in a concise way. So the name of the book is The Art of the Start by Guy Kawasaki. And he breaks down the process of starting a business into these stages. Causation, articulation, activation, and proliferation. Okay? And I will cover only this part, so the causation, which is starting the company. But it's an easy weekend read. It's not a long book. But he writes it extremely concisely, and he's an irreverent writer, so it's sort of fun to read his writing. So, starting. His model is, so that's just the first stage. But if you're starting a company, you should be thinking of the following. You should make meaning, make mantra, get going, define your business model, leave a map.
that stands for milestones, assumptions, and tasks. What do you think he means by make meaning? Before I show you the answer. That is true. I thought I was a professor. Then I found out I am a professor. So do I want to make meaning? Make meaning essentially in this view, and it turns out intuitively to the entrepreneurs, what is the change that I want to introduce? I mean, what is it that my company is going to do for the world? And no judgment, good or bad or whatever. In his writing, though, he tries to portray a social conscience. Now, I forgot to say, he was in charge of marketing at Apple. And then he's the founder of Garage.com, one of the venture capital firms that got started during the dot-com days. So, make meaning is usually not money, power, or prestige. Sometimes maybe, say, I'm doing a business purely because I want to make money. Often that just doesn't quite work. Make meaning, for example, if there's fine idea, and I'll tell you my own experience with one of my startups, Mind Sigma. I wanted to make meaning, and the make meaning was sourcing innovation worldwide. If the companies are going to need to get their innovation from outside because R&D is getting expensive, there are a lot of smart companies out there, then we put an infrastructure in place for companies to be able to do that routinely. So I wasn't so, thinking about money, power, or prestige. I was thinking, hey, am I smart enough to figure out an innovation that allows that facilitates changing the R&D model for the company? So that's the make meaning.
Concepts such as make the world a better place, of course, that sounds good. Increase the quality of life. Right a terrible wrong. Prevent the end of something good. I mean, these are some of the social conscience type of meaning. But make meaning. What is it that you're going to do with the company that's going to affect the world? Now, he does an example of negative things that are not suitable is, hey, we're going to start a company to drive Microsoft out of business. I mean, that is not a good driver to start a company because essentially in life you always want to be playing your own game rather than someone else's game. Because when you're playing your own game, you can construct the rules, and if you make the game attractive, eventually others will come and play your game. But if you're after someone else's game, you constantly have to learn their rules, and all your chances of winning aren't that high. Make mantra. What's a mantra? It's not a mission statement. Often these companies have a long mission statement. We are in business in pursuit of innovation for shareholder value increase, blah, blah, blah. It's not a tagline. Okay. His definition is a sacred verbal formula repeated in prayer, meditation, or incantation. Or a portion of scripture containing mystical potentiality. Okay, sort of. It's hard to define what a mantra is. And in fact, if you interview most entrepreneurs, they don't know what their mantra is. Okay? But they intuitively they have some. It's a short statement that expresses why of your venture. Why are you doing this venture? Examples. And he gives, these are out of his book, they're out of the start. Nike, authentic athletic performance. Now that tells you what Nike is about. Fun family entertainment, that tells you what Disney is about. Rewarding everyday moments, Starbucks. IBM, think. Winning is everything, Green Bay Packers. So mantra is sort of something that expresses what is Nine Sigma's mantra? Open innovation. Okay, that's what we're after.
instead of being inside your organization, doing close innovation, open up and connect with others outside. Compare these with the common mission statements you see in the annual report. You know, the mission statements are long, they're hard to remember. In fact, 9 Sigma has a mission statement too. I never remember. But I can remember open innovation. And you know, when you tell someone, they know what that's about, the people who are involved in that field. So, make meaning, make mantra, and get going. Get going doesn't mean write a business plan. Often people think, to start a business, I need a business plan. No, that's not the case. Doesn't mean having a presentation or building a financial model. It means build a prototype, write some software, launch a website, sell something. Okay, this is a very proactive approach. You know, essentially, talk is cheap. You know, get out there and make progress toward whatever it is that you're trying to sell. Okay? Once you've made progress and have some confidence, you have a prototype, you've got a software, you've launched your website, selling something, then you can go back and doing this. If you look in, I am currently, when do we stop then?
You get 10 minutes.
I currently have a collaboration with Professor G.Q. Zhang in computer science, okay? We're developing a search engine called MEMS World Online. In fact, you can go play with it, MEMS World Online by space.edu. Okay? What that search engine is about is, if you are interested in MEMS, if you put in a topic called query, depending on what you want, we either give you a list of experts, rank order of who is working in that topic or query area, or we give you a list of organizations that are experts, or you can do literature search. The problem with Google Scholar is that you go do a search, it spits out all this stuff. It's very hard. You want to know who to go to for accelerometers. You do a Google Scholar, you get a whole bunch of links, you've got to go look. You go to MEMS World Online, you put in accelerometers, we give you a rank order list of names who's doing accelerometers. You can click on them and see their publications. Now, clearly, we think there's a business potential in that. That's not funny in life. You've already filed our patents with the tech transfer, but you're not writing a business plan, you're not getting out there to do anything. You've implemented a prototype, you've put it on the web. In fact, in the last month, we've been sending out waves of sort of announcement to the MEMS community. I have their email addresses from conference attendance lists, right? I go to all the conferences, I have the conference attendance list. We send waves, and we don't first send it to all of them because there may be a big problem in this thing. So first send to about 40, 50. Let them get on there and then you tell us, you know, the truth. And so now we're sending it to about 500 people at a time. And sure enough, it's starting to validate that this is useful. People are really tracking this fast. And so at some point, you say, okay, we've got a prototype. It makes sense. You know, we've got it going. We've implemented it. Then let's look at, is there a startup opportunity? Is there a business model we can put around this? Or was it a great academic exercise and a service to the field? Hard to tell at this point in time. What we've done is we've gotten going. So, you know, no one ever achieved success by planning for gold. They started digging. You like that, huh? Okay. So, principles of getting going. Think big. You know, I always remember I had a teacher in junior high that used to say, if you study for an A, you likely will get a B. If you study for a B, you likely will get a C. So if you think high, at least you may end up in the basement. Okay. Find a few soulmates. It is very difficult nowadays to do anything by yourself. I just gave you an example. You know, I'm doing this project, MEMS World Online, with Professor Zhang in computer science. So, I have this idea of what would be a very useful tool to have. Okay. But nowadays, science technology is too complex, and business models are too complex for me to say, okay, now I'm going to go figure out how to write code for search engines, and then do everything. No, it's much faster to go partner with someone. So there's this professor in computer science, he already knows how to do data mining. All I have to do is go tell him, hey, if you have a tool like this, it'd be pretty useful. I think that we could implement it in all the fields, and we'd have a dynamite search engine. And he can be that far away. When you're ready, we can go find someone who knows how to put a business model around the search engine. Polarized people. Yeah, I'm not sure if I agree with this or not, but some people will love it, others will hate it. Indifference or lack of interest is what should be scary.
So the guy Kawasaki sort of believes in, a generating passion, evangelizing and generating passion. And so it says, the Mini Cooper is an example. Some people love it, some people hate it, there's very little in between. So you get a lot of emotions, so it becomes a topic of discussion.
Design different. There are multiple valid approaches to developing new product services, including I want one, sort of Porsche. He wanted a sports car that was such and such, and he couldn't find one, so he went and did one.
Use prototypes as market research. The Men's World Online is a great example of prototype.
Let's put it out there, see what people do with it. Again, MEMS World Online is a good example. There are many other examples. Let me see. Now, in everything, you have to have a business model.
The business model tells you how to make money. If you can't make money, you won't stay in business. So, who has your money in their pocket, essentially, is what you've got to figure out. Right? And then you have to figure out how to get your money out of their pocket into yours.
Okay. Be specific, keep it simple. Usually, try to copy an existing business model if you can.
Business model is not a good thing to innovate with because, there are a lot of business models that have been tried. A number of them work. Just try to use one of those. In my own personal experience, one of the toughest things for us was Nine Sigma business model because if we couldn't take an existing business model, we struggled for a couple of years. Finally, we took a couple of existing models and put them together and came up with the hybrid model for Nine Sigma.
So, and keep it simple so that you can explain the business model. The copy, if you can, this is a good place to copy. And finally, milestones, assumptions, and tasks. This is very useful to keep you in track and also figure out if you're making progress according to what you thought. It helps during early stages where you're juggling many things to keep things together and see if you're making progress, see what assumptions you made, are they correct or not, and what assumptions going forward you've made, what the chances are, what tasks you have ahead of you, what tasks you've accomplished. When you go to raise money from potential shareholders, they often ask you, sort of, what have you done so far? And if you can show them what you set out to do in terms of milestones, assumptions, tasks, and how well they worked out, or if they didn't work out, you understand why, then it improves your chances because it improves your credibility to the potential shareholder. I think that's it. I'm not going to do the details of these. So essentially, starting, make meaning, make mantra, get going, define your business model, be the man. And I'm not going to do the case studies because we talked about some of these companies. Questions?
No questions?
Come on.
Let's say I have a product. How would you know if it's better to sell your idea versus start a company?
That's a very good question. Especially in universities, we often face that. My own opinion is that if someone is
there and ready to buy your product or your idea, sell it and go on to the next one. Okay? Because this, you know, ideas aren't, it's not, if you're an innovator, this is not going to be your first idea, it's not going to be your last idea. It may be your first idea because you've been maturing, but it's not going to be your last one. So in my own personal preference is, if you've got something and some credible entity wants to buy it or license it or whatever, give it to them and move on to create the next one, because essentially you put someone else to work to implement your idea. You take it smaller cut, but you don't have to do the work. Okay? So if Google comes and wants to take Men's World Online, hey, it would be crazy not to do it. Then say we want to do a startup and so but it's not always so clear cut. Of course, to do it yourself, you have to have the passion, the interest, be willing to take the risk. And so in that spectrum, you can decide if the party that wants to get it from you is credible, what are the chances that it succeeds, what will be your share, and then you do an analysis of, if you do it yourself, how long it will take, what you need, what the risks will be, what your payoff will be, and then go from there. There was another question.
I was wondering about your Men's World Online. Is there any pictures you're using?
No.
It seems to be working.
I'm sorry, what?
It seems to be working too well.
Why?
I put in words like Iran, America.
No, it says don't put a name. You have to put a topical query.
Yes, like some parameter.
No, it says don't put in a name.
It seems like whatever I put in.
Put in, for example, it's so wrong if there's a pressure sensor.
Okay.
You have to do a copy call query. And specifically, you say don't put in a name, because the first thing everyone does is they go and put in their name. You don't do search by name. We are going to add a feature to do search by name on the literature search, but right now it's only copy call query. Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, go out there and start thinking about how to turn your senior projects.
So thanks for listening to me. Hope you got something out of this lecture.
Yes.
Before I lose this.